Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you live from Washington, D.C., headquarters of American Free Press. It's October 3rd. It's Tuesday night. And ideally, we are going to have a guest tonight. I talked to my proposed guest a little earlier this evening, and the producers are trying to get him on the line. He's very difficult to get on the phone, folks, but once you got him on the phone, you have a real prize there. So I'm not going to tell you who it is till I know he's going to be with us, because if we don't get him tonight, we'll get him some other night. Lots of big things in the news. It looks as though Russia and China are going to go along with President George W. Bush in the sanctions against Iraq. That's Iraq, I should say. Iran. Sanctions against Iran. Now, if that's the case, folks, that's going to throw a lot of throw a wet blanket on the ideas of those who like to think that the communists are somehow going to ally with Iran against the United States. A lot of misunderstandings about what's going on in that part of the world, but needless to say, I think it's a very, very tragic thing that the United States is following the Zionist line and trying to stop the Islamic Republic of Iran from accessing nuclear power. But that is the policy of the Zionists who are in control of the George W. Bush administration. And frankly, you know what, folks, there's very little we can do about it. But we can talk about it, and we can make people aware of it. And hopefully, in the future, there's going to be some way we can break the back of this monster. Well, I am pleased to tell you that we do have our guest here. I'm going to bring him up in a moment, and we have a break coming up, and all I need to say is his name, and you're going to know exactly who it is. He's the author of just so many important books that so many of us, both here in the United States, have read, books on controversial topics such as the New World Order, the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, Murder by Injection, and a very important book, A Writ for Martyrs, that explains precisely how criminal elements in the United States government work against law-abiding citizens who do one thing that seems to upset the powers that be, and that is speak out. And needless to say, I am talking about our guest, the one and only Eustace Mullins. Hello, Eustace. Well, Eustace is supposed to be there.
Hello.
There he is. All right. Thought we lost you there for a moment, Eustace.
I'm talking away here.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to have a break coming up here in just about a minute, but I just wanted to make sure that you were on board before we continued. Eustace, I'm glad you could come on the program tonight. You indicated you might only be able to stay an hour, but if I can twist your arm after an hour, I'm going to try to do it. But we'll see how things work in any case.
Oh, yes.
I told you this is just the second night of my the premiere of my two-hour broadcast. And, you know, I'll tell you, Eustace, I've done a lot of radio shows over the years like you have, but you know, when you're sitting behind a microphone and having to actually run the show, and you look at the clock and say, oh, my God, I got 2 hours ahead of me, it's like you just want to jump out the window.
Well, most of the shows I do go by awful fast.
Yeah, and that's what amazes me. Even last night's program, we were on here, it just seemed like I had just started the show, and the next thing I knew, 2 hours was coming up, so in any case, we do have our first break coming up here, and then we'll be coming right back. So, ladies and gentlemen, and Eustace, stay tuned. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington, D.C., right here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You are listening on to this network because you can handle the truth. So stay tuned. You're going to get a lot of truth tonight from Eustace Mullins. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington, D.C., right here on the Republic Broadcasting Network with a very special guest, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, last night here on this program, I made the prediction that this current scandal surrounding former Congressman Mark Foley of Florida, Congressman Mark Foley of Florida, would catapult a congressman from your home state, a nice, observant, Orthodox Jewish boy named Eric Cantor, into the Republican leadership. He's already now the fourth ranking.
Oh, he rose very fast. He was nobody in Richmond, and suddenly the name Cantor was everywhere.
Right. Well, now he's fourth ranking member in the House of Representatives on the Republican side, and it looks like the two top men, the Speaker of the House and the House Majority Leader, are fighting back and forth over this. Do you think it's possible that we are going to have our first Jewish House Speaker here in the next couple months?
Well, it's very possible. Cantor is certainly aiming for it, and he's gotten almost everything he wanted so far.
He's always gotten a lot of very good publicity here in the Washington, D.C. area, and they've been promoting him for a long, long time, so I think that's going to be the net effect of this scandal. But, you know, Eustace, you've been around the Washington, D.C. area on and off for a very, very long time, and you have seen how corruption and sexual shenanigans have been used to blackmail members of Congress and other politicians. And I wonder if you might want to reflect on any particular matters that might come to mind. I know you were telling me a little story about J. Edgar Hoover one day that I thought was kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was quite a guy. And he ruled through fear because he was afraid of everybody. You know, whenever I mentioned J. Edgar Hoover's name was mentioned when I first came to Washington in 1948, and I was hanging out at the National Press Club quite a bit because the founder, George Stimson, was a good friend of mine. He introduced me to everybody. And I noticed when a newspaper man ever mentioned J. Edgar Hoover's name, he kind of snickered. They wouldn't say anything, but they'd kind of snicker. And so I knew something odd was going on. But they wouldn't say anything about him at all. But they kind of looked like at you like you ought to know what's going on.
Okay.
And like everybody already knew it. So I got the picture pretty fast.
He managed to keep a lot of files and a lot of people and blackmail people himself. So, you know, I guess I wonder whatever happened to those files, Eustace. Have you ever heard anything to that effect?
All the black cabinet files were actually in the care of his secretary, and she died a few years later in Florida. And supposedly they were divided. The files were divided up among his worst enemies. So they could use them against each other.
What is that? There's a term for that. That's a Mexican standoff where you have a couple
different... It's a Mexican standoff, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's right. I mean, they have all these different groups that Hoover had kept his files on and everything. And you know, I commented that I figured this Congressman Foley was probably not a part of the club because they decided to throw him to the wolves, but... what we're not hearing about is all the real shenanigans among so many others who for whatever reason, aren't getting their names in the papers.
Not at all. There's stuff going on all over Washington. You know, I used to eat breakfast with those pages at Library of Congress every morning.
Oh, yeah, well, that's right. She would be right up here in Capitol Hill working at the library at that time, yeah.
Well, I went to the cafeteria because there wasn't any more place to eat early on Capitol Hill at that time. Now, I got there at 9 o'clock in the morning. And then there were two tables that come in with these page boys, and I'd be sitting there eating my lunch. And they weren't loud or anything. They were very well-dressed. You know, they looked like prep school boys with white shirts and ties. And I could see where some of these politicians might be interested in them. I think they always were.
Yeah, I often, you know, as all these scandals have come up, you know, where, they, you know, of course they added the female pages back in the, I think probably in the early 1980s or something like that.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't much of a change at all. Things went on just about the same way.
Well, what I often wondered is if they haven't deliberately set that page operation up there just to kind of monitor the interaction of members of Congress with these young people. I mean, you know, we've heard stories time and again about all sorts of things going on Capitol Hill, you know, but I thought, you know, coming back to J. Edgar Hoover, you know, in my latest book, the Judas Goats, I have a very special page in that book reproducing an actual document that J. Edgar Hoover signed off on, in which he was actually proposing, he and his FBI associates, I think one of his Jewish associates, Alex Rosen, Eustace, they had a plan to put you in an insane asylum because you didn't, because they didn't like what you were saying about J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, that's right. J. Edgar Hoover called me the most dangerous man in America because he thought I was dangerous to him. I wasn't dangerous to anybody else.
But, yeah, tell the audience a little bit about that, Eustace, because it's kind of something that, you know, people see movies about things like this. But they never expect the possibility that something like this can happen in real life. And J. Edgar Hoover was supposed to be one of our great patriots.
Oh, he really was. He was anti-communist. And this famous picture of him with a machine gun, which he never fired, that went all over the world.
But he actually had this plan then to put you, find any way he could to put you in an insane asylum.
Oh, he got there were 10 assistant directors of the FBI, each one of which is enormously powerful. And he notified the 10 assistant directors of the FBI that this was to be top priority to put Mullins in a mental institution. And, of course, I was in Chicago and knew nothing about any of this whatsoever.
Of course, the FBI was busy harassing a lot of your friends and associates, too, during this time. So that's something, you know, again, people thought that in those days that the FBI was going out after after communists and after bad men, but it turned out the FBI was going after writers like Eustace Mullins.
Well, and writers who would not like to, yeah. They went after Ernest Hemingway and Shirley Temple and people like that. I think he was always with an eye of publicity more than anything else. He wasn't really chasing anti-communists. And in fact, they knew for years that the New York office of the FBI was loaded with communists because that's where the communists were. And so people began to needle him about these communists in the FBI office in New York. And it made him mad. And I wrote a letter to the newspaper about it once, and my local newspaper. And, of course, they forwarded it right to him, and he fired a hot letter back, and he says, Mullins will write anything about anybody. Don't pay any attention to him. And so, I was noising it about that I was going to run for a senator from Virginia because I was protege of H.L. Hunt at the time, who was the richest man in America, or the world, I forget which, but anyway, he had money.
And, he had lots of money in any case, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he never gave me a penny, so I didn't run for the Senate.
You know, that's the legend about H.L. Hunt was that he was a piggy bank for the right wings and the right wing and the patriots and the nationalists in America. But everyone I have ever known who knew of H.L. Hunt said he never gave a penny to anybody, and yet the left wing and the Jewish organizations always said that H.L. Hunt was bankrolling all these different organizations, and nothing could have been further from the truth.
Oh, no, I know for a fact. He never gave a dime to anybody, because the thing was, if he ever gave any money to anybody, he'd get 1,800 calls the next morning from people wanting more money.
People who wanted more money, exactly.
Well, that's why he wasn't being stingy. He just didn't want his doors being broken down by all of these supplicants and wanting money.
Which you can understand why, but on the other hand, you know, at the same time, as I say, it was always the legend that that's where the money was and for the right wing, for the patriots, that there was this Texas billionaire, that there was this flamboyant image of this Texas billionaire who was the piggy bank for the quote unquote extreme right, and of course, well, as we just said, nothing could have been further from the truth. So.
No, I happen to be right in the middle of it the whole time, and I know that I don't know if anybody they ever gave a penny to. And He was resolved to leave all of his money to his family members, and he did exactly that. He died. Now, I don't know how much his money he was making, but at one time, Life magazine said he was making $1 million a week. And I asked him about that one time. I said, I saw that story in 1956 that you were making $1 million a week. And he said, well, that wouldn't touch it. He said, I was making $12 million a week at that time. They didn't know what they were talking about. So he had the money. There's no doubt about that.
He just wasn't parting with it like they said he did.
No. It didn't slip through his fingers.
Yeah, well, Eustace, you've known so many people in your career. It boggles the mind. But I think, of course, you're probably your most famous friend and associate is, of course, the late Ezra Pound. And, you know, we have a break coming up here in a minute or so. But when we come back, I'd like you to reflect on Ezra Pound because a lot of our younger listeners, frankly, don't know who he is, and they need to know who he is because what happened to Ezra Pound for speaking out can happen to anybody. So when we come back, Eustace, from this forthcoming break, let's talk about Ezra Pound and how you got to know him and how he led you into the thicket of the Federal Reserve System.
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm glad
quite
to
a story there. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, you're going to hear firsthand from Eustace Mullins the origins of the first big expose of the Federal Reserve System in America, the banker-controlled corruption that misrules the world. Gentlemen, welcome back. This is Michael Collins Piper with a very special guest here on this program tonight. I've had the honor of knowing Eustace Mullins for, I guess, about, well, I started to work for Liberty Lobby in 1980, and I first met him in 1980, so that makes it 26 years, and little did I know that 26 years after I first met him, I would have him on my own radio show, and lo and behold, I do. Anyway, Eustace.
Yep.
You are a friend and protege of the late poet Ezra Pound, and it was Ezra Pound who first focused you in the direction of the Federal Reserve System, and it can be said very, very honestly and without qualification that if you had not written your book, the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, been reissued as Secrets of the Federal Reserve, but if you had not written that book, millions and millions of people would know nothing about the Federal Reserve System. So if you could, just give us a few minutes and talk about how you got onto the Federal Reserve through your association with Ezra Pound.
Well, I got onto it through Ezra Pound, and quite simply, when he asked me to go to the Library of Congress and see what I could find out about the Federal Reserve System, I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System.
Okay.
And so he had to pull a dollar bill out of his bathrobe at the lunatic asylum there and show me a greenback note with the Federal Reserve prominently on the top, millions of people handle those bills every day, and they never see those signs of Federal Reserve on the top because they don't pay any attention to it.
Don't pay any attention to it, that's right. Mm-hmm.
But after my book, I told them about the Federal Reserve and the fact that it was not federal. It had no reserves because it printed all the money it wanted.
How many copies of the Federal Reserve book and its various incarnations have you yourself distributed, Eustace? Because I know a lot of people who have plagiarized your work. A lot of people have pirated your work. But how many copies do you know of yourself that are in circulation?
Well, about a million.
That's amazing.
Oh, yes. But there's 18 plagiarizations of it, and there's actually have been about 20 million books, copies of that book, distributed in this country since 1953 when I printed the first printing.
Well, you know, I can tell you, Eustace, whenever I went over to Malaysia this past year, I'd been over there once before, but I met a guy from somewhere in, I can't even remember where, one of the stands, as they call them, in Eastern Europe, Western Asia.
Oh, yeah.
A guy who's now living in Malaysia, and he was eager to talk to me, and after he was done telling me how much he liked my books, he said to me, he says, I have to ask you a question. He says, do you know Eustace Mullins? And when I told him that I knew Eustace Mullins, his face lit up like a Christmas tree.
Well, that book has gone around the world. It's amazing.
Yeah, he was, he had read your book years and years ago, went through a great deal of trouble to get a copy of it, you know. And my friend Matthias Chang, who's the former political secretary to Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who, of course, has been a big critic of the international banks, in his book, Future Fast Forward, he pays tribute to your work on the Federal Reserve System. And so, like I say, Eustace, what Ezra Pound gave birth to through pointing you in the direction of the Federal Reserve has reached millions and millions of people. And, you know, if you had never written, I can say this safely, if you had never written another word after your book on the Federal Reserve, you would be a legend. But you've written so many other books on other topics. You did The History of the Jews.
The New History of the Jews.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Mullins' New History of the Jews, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The Biological Jew.
Oh, yes.
Murder by Injection. A Writ for Martyrs. And I keep thinking, oh, well, and of course, The World Order, but I keep thinking I'm missing one.
Well, Curse of Canaan was the real one. That was a demonology in world history.
That's right, Curse of Canaan. Okay, yeah.
Curse of Canaan's got a lot of terrific stuff in there.
Yeah, now, Eustace, where can people get your books? I mean, can you give out an address where people can write you, or what's the best way for those who don't have copies of your books to get the ones that are available?
Well, I have some available right here in at my home in Stanton, Virginia. It's 126 Madison Place, Stanton, Virginia, 24401.
126 Madison Place.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And Stanton, Virginia is also, by coincidence, the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson, the traitor who betrayed us to the international bankers with the Federal Reserve System.
That's kind of ironic, you know.
It is quite ironic. Wilson's birthplace is about four blocks from where I'm talking to you on the phone right now. keeping his name alive.
That just goes to show you that that one place can bring out one good apple and at least one bad apple, too. So that's for sure. All right, Eustace. Well, I tell you what, believe it or not, we're already swinging to our half-hour break here, and we've got four calls, including a couple people who've been on from the very beginning. So when we come back from the break, we'll let the listeners talk to Eustace Mullins.
Oh, that'll be very good.
All right, great. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned and listen to these commercials very carefully, because the people who advertise on this network help keep this network alive. Patronize the advertisers, folks.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington with our very special guest, Eustace Mullins. I find it hard to believe that there'd be anybody out there among the listeners who didn't ever hear of Eustace Mullins or at least read something by him. And I can tell you that if you've ever read anything about the Federal Reserve System written in English or in maybe even any other language, chances are that if Eustace didn't write those words himself, somebody else relied heavily on the works of Eustace Mullins to write the words that you did read. So, in any case, that having been said, we're going to go to our callers here, Eustace.
All right.
All right. We have John from Tennessee. John, come on up.
Hi, how you doing?
How you doing tonight, John?
I'm doing great, man, even though the world's going to hell. I got in trouble yesterday. I made about 50 phone calls to people in my town, and I told them, within 5 minutes, I told them that there's a nuclear war going on in Iraq. And most of them listened, and everybody, you know, and I told them about RBN before it was over. And, and I got a phone call at 9 o'clock at night. And they said what I was doing was illegal.
Well, you know, John, you know, we were just talking here with Eustace about the fact that the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, was doing everything he could to shut Eustace up. So if they go to the lengths they did to try to go after Eustace Mullins, who has at least some public profile, what do you think the people in the New World Order forces and the Jewish organizations like the Anti-Defamation League are going to do? What do you think about that, Eustace?
Well, you know, a little Jewish printer on the Lower East Side printed the first printing of the Federal Reserve in 1953.
No kidding.
And I stopped by to see him one day, and he said, "You're still walking around?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I thought you'd be in jail." He said, "You know, that book is criminal libel from beginning to end." And this was the printer. So I guess he was afraid he'd go to prison himself. But I was very surprised by that because I had never thought of libeling anybody.
That issue, one of the early printings of the book, was actually officially burned by the German government, wasn't it?
Oh, 10,000 copies were burned by a communist spy in the East Germany. And the poor guy that printed the book, put his life savings into it, was Guido Reiter, and he managed the Obergamerau passion play in Germany.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's interesting.
And it wiped him out.
Well, you know, John, the best advice I can give you is just to watch your back there, because that's part of the problem. When you go out there and speak out and make your voice heard, it's the kind of thing that you kind of expect to happen. But, you know, Eustace made that decision a long, long time ago, and he's been through a lot, but he's still with us, thank God.
Well, you know, 24 hours a day, you guys are pointing at the Great Tribulation.
Well, you know, it's you know what I always say, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. That's why.
And you know what? We're going to win this war, but we're going to have to suffer.
Well, I think Eustace is here to tell us that he's had members of his own family really suffered greatly as a consequence of what the FBI did to him and to them over the years. So you're talking to somebody, that is Eustace Mullins, who has had those experiences. Is that not right, Eustace?
Well, you know, the FBI terrorizes my family for years, and they used to go around and to my family members here in Stanton, Virginia, and they'd say, "I hope you've got a good picture of Eustace so you remember him, because you're not going to see him again for a long time."
You know, and they're the ones that talk about terrorism. I think that's terrorism of its worst sort.
That is terrorism. I'll tell you, my family was terrorized. Some of them are still afraid to talk to me.
Well, you know, again, this is all part and parcel of the effort to not just terrorize people, which they do terrorize people, but they demonize people. And,
demonize, yes.
That's exactly right. Well, John, I'm going to thank you for your call.
One more thing.
Well, go ahead. We have quite a few callers lined up here.
Okay, Jesus Christ is coming, and that's what this is all about. And there's people out there that got money, and they're not contributing a dime.
Well, that's what we were talking about earlier with H.L. Hunt. He certainly was in moral support of the Patriot movement in America, but he didn't open up his bank account like he was often said to have opened it up. So That's why.
No, he never did, because, and I never resented that, because I understood why he was doing it. I lived in his home with his family for quite a long time.
Yeah, I understand he was actually himself. He was very, what's the word, frugal, I guess. He was not really extravagant with the money that he did accumulate. So it's not like he was deliberately trying to bilk anybody, but groups like the Anti-Defamation League played him up as a way of making a lot of good patriots think that they didn't need to contribute to.
Oh, that's exactly right. With Hudson money, they didn't need to. The Patriots didn't need to give any money.
Yeah, that's right. So that's exactly. That's it. Patriots said, well, H.L. Hunt's financing Eustace Mullins or financing this organization or that organization. So, therefore, they didn't open up their bank accounts. Well, John, your point is well taken. Let's go to Joe in Pennsylvania. Joe, come on up. What do you have to say to Eustace Mullins?
Yeah, a few quick things. Mr. Mullins, first off, I'm a young person, and I respect your work. What I wanted to ask first was, you know, in this movement, there's a lot of allegations of everyone being anti-Semitic, and I think we have to be careful of that. Are you against the Jewish people as a whole, or are you against Zionism and the religion?
Oh, I'm against Zionism. No, I'm not against Jewish people. When I went to New York City in 1948, I lived with Ben Friedman for months, and he fed me and everything. And the first person who publicly praised my Federal Reserve book in 1953 was Myron Fagan, and he was the most Jewish person that you could ever meet.
Yes, I've heard of them. And also, I was just wondering, you've pointed out, I think, that the Rockefellers, I guess, funded Hitler, right?
Oh, yes. And they funded the Federal Reserve System, the Rockefellers. Well, they were an agent of the Rothschilds. See, the Rothschilds actually put up the money for the Standard Oil Company, because when John D. Rockefeller started the Standard Oil Company, which became the biggest monopoly in the world, he was a $10-a-week bank clerk. Now, you don't start worldwide monopolies with a $10 bill.
Okay, well, what I was getting to was, you know, if Hitler was a tool, I heard that you wrote an article called Adolf Hitler in Appreciation. And
the ADL brings that up. It was one paragraph. What I did, I put a filler in a little paper once called Adolf Hitler in Appreciation, in which I said that Adolf Hitler actually worked against the evil forces in the world. And so they've reprinted that for 50 years to show what a terrible person I really am.
Okay, and that's what I wanted to ask. But one more thing. You know, Ezra Pound pretty well. Is there any... I really like to read some of his work. What would you suggest I read?
Well, his greatest work is an epic poem called The Cantos.
Right.
And that's a big, thick book. That's in print. His books are in print in New Directions Press, New York City. And
okay.
They can be obtained. In fact, you once in a while will find a little book of his, a slim book of poems, in a used bookstore, but it's not very often. They just don't like to put his name out where anybody can see it.
Right, and I was reading about Cantos, and I guess, I don't know if you know about this, but I've read that he had, I don't think the terminology is really correct, but there was an occult influence on his work. Not occult as in defining it as the capacity of the human soul to apprehend the truth directly.
Oh, there was one goofy woman who campaigned for years claiming I was a disciple of the devil because I knew Ezra Pound. And she traveled the country and held camp meetings denouncing me and Ezra Pound both as being members of the occult. Well, the story behind that was that when Ezra was a young man in England at the start of his career, he contributed articles to a New Age publication. It was called The New Age. And he was just a guest writer for them. And ever since then, this woman has said that he was a tool of occult forces, which he never knew any occult forces in his life.
What I meant, though, was he a spiritual person?
Was he a spiritualist?
Yeah.
Not really. He was more interested in the social credit movement. He was a great sponsor of the National Credit Movement, International Social Credit Movement, and he was one of the principal spokesmen for it. But he was more interested in money than spiritualism.
Okay, thank you. It's great to hear from a legend like yourself.
Okay.
Joe, thanks for your call. Always glad to hear young people. You know, it used to be that I mentioned this at our American Free Press conference over Labor Day weekend. It used to be I'd go to those conferences and I was the youngest person there. And now, increasingly, as I go to the conferences, I'm joining the oldsters.
Oh yeah, you get old before you know it.
That's the way it goes. Okay. All right, we have Mark from New York. Mark, come on up.
Hello.
How are you, Mark?
Very fine, Michael. I have a question for Eustace.
Go ahead.
The caller before was talking about Ezra Pound, and Ezra Pound certainly had some very famous pupils, you might say. I think T.S. Eliot, who was a Nobel laureate.
Oh, well, five of his proteges got the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Did he ever talk to you about them?
Pardon?
Did he ever talk to you about Eliot?
Oh, yes, he talked about it. We talked about everything. I was with him 3 hours a day, and he did all the talking. I was a listener.
Have you ever written, you know, you are a tremendous font of information and wisdom, and you should write about your own life, not just...
Well, I'm working on my autobiography right now because I'm doing it out of respect to the people I've known. There's so many things that I can tell present generation about all of these people that I knew from a personal basis by knowing them. And now I want to get those that information out to everybody.
I'm surprised that there aren't people from English literature departments.
Oh, nobody with English
trying
literature
to knock
department
down your door to get to interview you.
They won't touch me with a 10-foot pole. I've never been asked to speak to any group at any American university or even a school in the United States. And when Ezra was released from St. Elizabeth's, all charges dropped against him. He was released. And he was waiting to go back to Italy for about 6 months.
Right.
And during that time, no American university invited him to speak. He was never interviewed, and there were no newspaper interviews or anything. It was like he was an untouchable. Nobody could mention his name.
You know, Mark, I was delinquent in not mentioning, and actually Eustace didn't mention it either, but Eustace actually wrote a book about his experiences with Ezra Pound. It's This Difficult Individual is the name of the book. And
is it available?
Well, that's the thing. Eustace, that book has been pretty much washed down the memory hole, hasn't it, by the...
Yeah, it's been out of print for quite a while because there was such a blackout. I wrote the book and published it in 1959, and no one reviewed the book, so...
Well, actually, you know, it did get a review that I have a copy of the book here in front of me, and it's a very interesting that it did get reviewed, but that it was still, they managed to suppress this book.
Oh, it's very suppressed.
Arnold Gingrich, writing in Esquire magazine, writes
this. Oh, Gingrich, the Gingrich review was very good. He wrote in Esquire magazine, and he was Jewish himself, but he wrote, this book is
a
book about Ezra
Pound. I have a quote right here, Eustace.
Oh, yes.
This book about Ezra Pound comes as close as any book can without being actually written by Ezra Pound.
Wow.
For its insight into the most difficult years of this difficult individual. Now, the fact, as Eustace pointed out here to you, Mark, the fact that that this book has been so suppressed and the fact that people in these English departments and literature departments will not touch you. This just goes to show you how influential his other political work has been, that they don't even want to acknowledge this other, really, in some senses, non-political writing that he's done.
But it just seems to me as though when you have firsthand knowledge of a giant like Ezra Pound, if he's the person who sort of taught people like T.S. Eliot what to look for, And so many other scholars, and it just seems like it's absolutely absurd that they wouldn't be chasing Eustace down and say, please tell us these personal things that you knew.
Oh, you would think so. You'd think they'd be lined up to get these lectures, colleges, but I have never been asked to lecture at any American college.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely. It tells it all.
Well, if there's any way of getting a hold of that, you know, something with that book, I mean, if you just photocopy the pages and make them available on the internet, I'll pay for something. If, you know, send
Mark,
a paper to Eustace.
You know, that's what I was going to say. Maybe, maybe that, maybe that's what needs to be done, Eustace. Maybe American Free Press, if the resources were there, could sponsor publication of a new edition of that book.
Well, it'd be welcomed all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was lucky to get a copy of it myself from the estate of my late friend Lois Peterson. And,
oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have a copy of the book. I have, and you know, I go to a lot of secondhand used bookstores, Eustace, all over the country, and you know, I've never seen a secondhand copy of the book in any bookstore anywhere. So that says a lot. They've managed to suppress that book. So
oh, they certainly have. I did manage to pick up. I was lecturing in Pennsylvania at some small town, and I went to a bookstore, and there was one copy of This Difficult Individual, Ezra Pound, for $15, and I bought it on the spot. It had the original jacket and everything.
Jacket and everything. What do you know about that? Well, that's it. That's a book, then. That's a book for people to look for in the secondhand bookstores. I mean, it may be out there. Yeah,
they'll get lucky.
Well, you know, the thing is, in this short term, you know, I would say in immediate history, maybe you'll be overlooked. But you know, as time passes, your knowledge is going to be very important to people. And
it's important to the memory of Ezra Pound. That's what I'm fighting for.
Not just that, your work, his work, the people that work, the insights, these things. They should be passed on for generations in the future.
Oh, it certainly should.
I just hope that happens somewhere along the way.
Well, I'm still working to make it happen, and
A lot of luck to you, and I hope you have many, many more years.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark, thanks for your call. We're going to the break now. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. A few more callers here have joined us. Want to speak to the one and only, the legendary Eustace Mullin. Stay tuned. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you here in Washington, D.C. with Eustace Mullins, who is not real far away in Stanton, Virginia. It's a couple hours by train, but it's a real beautiful part of the country that's, I think, probably a lot cleaner and safer and less corrupt than Washington, D.C. Eustace, we've got quite a few callers lined up here. Can I twist your arm to stay on beyond the turn of the hour to take these calls?
Oh, yeah, I'll take the calls.
All right, great. Well, we have Chris calling in from Chicago. I haven't heard from Chris, if it's the Chris I think it is, in a while. So welcome back, Chris.
It's good to be back, Mike. Thanks.
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah.
Very good. I have a couple of historical questions about Ezra Pound and another poet named George Sylvester Fierak, who was also
was
jailed.
Yeah, Eustace, go ahead.
Okay. George Sylvester Fierak was the grandson of Kaiser Wilhelm I, and he represented German interests in this country in both world wars. And I used to tease him that he cost Germany victory in both world wars. And instead of being insulted, he seemed rather flattered by it. It was
That's exactly what I was going to ask about. And he had a homosexual relationship with a Jewish Zionist literateur named Ludwig
Lewis. Oh, Ludwig Lewis, yeah. That was, well, he was just a kid himself at that time. But Sylvester had a strange idea that to be a poet, you had to be homosexual, because Oscar Wilde was a very popular poet at that time and was homosexual. But this was just a misunderstanding of his. He actually was not really homosexual, but he had some homosexual tendencies. And he did have homosexual flings with three or four very prominent and very wealthy Jewish people in New York City. But
you
this
think
was
he
long
was...
before I knew him.
Do you think he was secretly working for the Zionist cause the whole time?
Oh, never. No, indeed. He was pure German. He was a Hohenzollern.
Well, they actually sent him to jail, did they not, Eustace, if I'm not mistaken, during World War II. Wasn't he imprisoned as a...
He was imprisoned for 6 years, and he had a Jewish lawyer who filled out lots of registration papers as a German representative in the United States. And the Jewish lawyer put something on the wrong line, and they gave him 6 years and Leavenworth for that.
Yeah,
and when he came out, he was flat broke.
Was Pound going to write a book about the international Jewish bankers, and did you take over that project for him?
I more or less took it over. He really was going. He never wrote a book about it, but he did want to write a book. And they called me in Washington. They called me Ezra Pound's Revenge because I was his revenge for his imprisonment. And really, I think he rather relished that idea because I did the things that he couldn't do because he was in prison.
Sigmund Freud tried to claim that anti-Semitism was a form of mental illness. Why was
Sigmund Freud was high on cocaine most of the time. In fact, cocaine is so popular in Hollywood today among the actors and producers because they're all followers of Sigmund Freud. They believe that by taking cocaine, they're worshiping at the feet of their master.
And one last question. What did you think and what did they think of Huey Long?
Oh, they liked Huey Long. Huey Long was a real American.
You think he could have saved us from the bankers?
He could have, yes. He understood the situation. He fought Standard Oil and the Rockefellers and Rothschilds. He fought them to a standstill in Louisiana because it was quite an oil refinery state. And that's the reason they killed him.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
All right, Chris, thanks for your call. Ladies and gentlemen, we're signing off for a few moments here, but we're going to come back to begin the second hour, and we're going to take your calls for Eustace Mullins. 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. I know you want to talk to Eustace, so please feel free to call in before he has to turn in for the evening, like we all need to do. Commercial interruption, which was much needed and much necessary. We are returning to the air. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington, D.C. We have Eustace Mullins on the line from Stanton, Virginia. We have quite a few callers lined up here, but before we go to the callers and back to Eustace, I just want to remind you that RBN is still on the pledge drive, and if you have not yet made your pledge to RBN, or if you have not made a contribution, just a single one-time contribution to RBN, if you can, now is the time to do it. You can call RBN's office at 800. It's an 800 number, folks, 800-724-2719, 800-724-2719. You know, you can also patronize Republic Trading, very important part of the RBN network. That number is 800-691-7898, 800-691-7898. In regard to Republic Trading, you know, mentioned last night on the program, in the Muslim countries, they're talking about a gold dinar, a dinar tied to gold, because of the very important value of gold. They see gold as the way of breaking away from the international banks and this Federal Reserve System that Eustace Mullins has been writing about, this Federal Reserve System that impacts upon the entire world because it's in the hands of these global bankers. So you need to call Republic Trading at 800-691-7898. This support for RBN is necessary because there would not be a network without your support, and you wouldn't be able to hear people like Eustace Mullins, who is not going to be interviewed on ABC or CBS or NBC. All right. Well, Eustace, we had to do that because, you know, this network needs the support of the people out there. You know, people just don't realize that, we talked about it earlier, and that wasn't a setup when we talked about it, the fact that everybody thought that H.L. Hunt, the Texas oil billionaire, was giving his money away to all the patriots when nothing could be further from the truth. So
they were hoping it was the truth because they didn't have to give anything then.
That's right. That's exactly right. Okay, Eustace. Well, we have a caller here, Bob from D.C., and if it's who I think it is, I believe you and I both know Bob. Let's bring him up.
Hello, Mike and Eustace. How are you?
Yeah, there we go.
Hello.
Hi, Eustace. I got your letter today. Thank you.
Oh, very good.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that so much.
Well, I think I pretty well explained it, so you can expand on it as much as you want to.
Yeah, and plus I took notes the last time. You know, an interesting thing, Mike, that Eustace brought out about his book, The Great Betrayal, and that is that originally, coming from the Articles of Confederation and into the Constitution, the underlying emphasis was that the federal government was to protect the states. And I think I'm right on that. Am I not right on that, Eustace?
Oh, yes. There was to be no direct contact between the individual citizens and the federal government, because the federal government was sort of the cement that held the states together. So, therefore, the principal duty of the federal government was to promote the welfare of the states and make them viable entities.
Well, you know, that's quite a remarkable contrast to what we've really been taught in the schools and what we've been taught in our culture and by the media. I mean, you know, that in itself, in some respects, is a big surprise to me, and I like to think of myself as being fairly well-read, and yet...
Well, it's very revolutionary, and I'm the only person that's ever brought it out.
Yeah, well, it is quite revolutionary, because it's... the irony is it stems back to the whole concept of the revolution. Well, here we go to our first break, folks. Hang on there, Bob and Eustace and everybody else. This is Michael Collins Piper. We'll be back in a minute or two. Stay tuned. Folks, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington with our special guest, Eustace Mullins, who's down there in Stanton, Virginia at 126 Madison Place. Eustace's address is Eustace Mullins, 126 Madison Place, Stanton, Virginia. And that's spelled not like it sounds. It's spelled S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N. S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N, Virginia. And what's the zip code there, Eustace?
24401.
24401.
Yeah.
Okay, we want to make sure people want to write you. That's where they can write. Okay. All right, we have Bob from D.C. Bob, I have to tell you something. Over the break, it occurred to me, you mentioned a title of a book by Eustace that I have to confess, in retrospect, I don't think I was aware you had written this book, Eustace, The Great Betrayal.
Oh, that's my last published book, because it was a story of the Constitution and the General Welfare Clause.
You know, Eustace, I was not aware of that book at all. I mean, on the one hand, I'm embarrassed to say it, but on the other hand, I'm glad to say that I now know the book was written, and thanks to Bob for bringing that to my attention. That's very interesting.
Well, yeah, rather tells you the story of the welfare clause. It's a very big story.
Eustace, the way you explained it to me was just mind-boggling to me. I had never looked at it that way. And
oh, yes.
And in this little tract, you were so gracious to mail me, and I will get this up on that blog that I'm setting up.
All right.
You mentioned a lady's name, Bella Moskowitz, that she was one of the people that helped get FDR elected.
She was the person who got him elected, and he chose her because he had put Al Smith in as governor of New York before Franklin D. Roosevelt decided to run for the office. And Roosevelt was so impressed with her abilities at vote-getting that he... commissioned Bella Moskowitz to back his run for the presidency.
Now, is that in your book, The Great Betrayal?
I think it is, yeah.
Ah, boy, I got to get that.
I don't. It may not be that detailed, but it's in there.
Well, Mike, I want to let you know, and I've been putting together this blog, and all it is a simple, a very simple informational web blog with the books that Eustace has in stock and his address.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, do you have an address you can give out now, or
sure.
Do we have to wait? Oh, what fantastic. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm working on it as I talk, and I have not got this book up yet because I did not have a synopsis, an abstract, And that's what Eustace had mailed to me as an abstract.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, go ahead and give us that address.
That'll be up tomorrow. It's Eustace Mullins with no spaces. It's contiguous. EUSTACEMULLINS. That's Eustace Mullins with no spaces. .blogspot. That's BLOGSPOT.com.
Well, that's fantastic. EustaceMullins.blogspot.com.
Right. And the three books are up there now, Eustace.
Oh, good.
As you saw, I mailed you the copies of what I had.
Oh, yes.
And I added the one. And then The Great Betrayal will be up there by tomorrow.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. And that's if people want further information on Eustace's books, they can go right to that spot and get his address and everything.
And these will be the books that he has in stock.
Excellent. Excellent.
I'm sure I will eventually go in and get a synopsis of the other books. And I went up on the web and got what I could get, but some of it naturally was by detractors. So that'll take some time to get that together. And I will hopefully get a hold of some of these books myself. I have none of these books, and I am going to get some from Eustace soon.
Well, so, Bob, you know, thank God you thought of doing what you did, because I know Eustace has been having some problems over the last couple of years getting control of his books, and it's been pretty tough for you, Eustace, but you're still fighting.
Oh, I've only been doing this for 60 years.
Yeah,
and Mike, and Eustace said anybody that goes and orders a book from him will get a signed copy, naturally.
Oh, great.
So yeah. You know, they can look forward to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're getting used to that, too, Mike.
I've signed a few in the last couple of years. I'm always amazed when somebody wants my signature, but I guess I should be flattered. So,
well, you know, Jimmy Carter, when he put his crappy books out, he sold them, and he charged $300 if he autographed them. But he donated it all to charity, so he didn't have to pay any taxes for the next 100 years.
Well, that's a pretty good deal. I wish I'd have known how to do that.
Well, you should ask Jimmy. He knows how to do it.
All right. Well, listen, Bob, I want to thank you for bringing that information to us. I knew you were working on a blog spot for Eustace, but I didn't know how far you were on it. So that's EustaceMullins.blogspot.com.
Right.
That's fantastic. All right, Bob, listen, appreciate that, and you know where to get it, so.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. That's great, Eustace. That is fantastic.
Oh, things are moving right along.
That's great. Okay. Well, now we have David joining us from Massachusetts. David, are you there?
Well, hello, gentlemen. How are you? Good to talk to you, Mr. Mullins.
Hello, David.
There's a book I have, Selected Prose, on Ezra Pound, edited with an introduction by William Cookson. A New Directions book come out.
Oh, yeah, they're New Directions books. So they're keeping his name in print. You know, he got James Laughlin, the heir of the Jones and Laughlin steel fortune. He came to him in Italy in 1934 and asked Ezra, well, what should I do with some of my money? And Ezra said, start a publishing house. And so he did, and that's how New Directions came into being. And that's why Ezra has a publisher today.
Well, that's very good. Good to hear that. Concerning Mr. Pound, I have looked through quite a bit of this book. I haven't read every page, but I've read a lot of it. And it's very obvious that Ezra Pound, as I interpret his writings, is anti-central bank.
Oh, very much so.
Very much against the central bank idea. He praises that bank up in northern Italy, the bank Banco dei Paschi. And that seems, from what I read, as the opposite of the central banking system. And then I think he praised former President Jackson and Van Buren for the sub-treasury system that they had set up in the 1830s.
Oh, yes.
And what I wanted to say is this. I have read books by Ludwig von Mises, who seems to be the patron saint of conservatism. And Ludwig von Mises seems to me to be the very opposite of Ezra Pound, because
von Mises was brought as a political refugee. He was brought by John D. Rockefeller to the United States, and Rockefeller gave him a job.
Well, it's good to hear you say that, because I had heard that on a radio program many years ago, and I read something that, I'm sorry I didn't keep it, but if you keep everything that you should, you'd have a mile high of papers, that, you know, Ludwig von Mises and Hayek, who wrote that book, The Road to Serfdom.
Oh, yes.
Both of those people were strong supporters of the central bank, a gold standard. And also I want to mention that in 1935, Germany and Italy went off the gold standard.
Oh, yes.
They went off it. Their governments, their leaders, they didn't want the country to be on the gold standard. And another thing, I don't mean to stray from our conversation, and I won't for very long, but one of the reasons that Germany and Italy and Japan, which were quite powerful governments at the time, got out of the League of Nations is they were sick and tired of Britain controlling the world supply of gold, and Britain controlled the League of Nations.
Of course, yeah. Woodrow Wilson was a stooge of theirs, and he was the proponent of the League of Nations.
There is a book out on something like this that was printed in Italy back in the 30s, in which the allegations were made, and I'm sure they're all true, that the main reason for the setup of the League of Nations was so that the powerful and wealthy citizens of Britain and France could run the world.
Absolutely. Bank of England had its goal to run the world.
Absolutely true. And I think that the big reason that Germany and Italy and Japan got out of the League of Nations is they weren't going to be in any organization in which one country did all the running and everybody else was just expected to step in line.
Well, that's how they became the central powers during the World War. And they were the enemy because they wouldn't join up with the rest of the bankers.
And also, too, let's see, what else about this? Getting into some gentleman here before mentioned Huey Long.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, some gentleman previous to my call. And Huey Long, I know, did back Roosevelt for the Democratic nomination in 1932. And then not too long after that, within 2 years, I think that they were no longer on speaking terms. And then finally, as you know, in 1935, a suicidal maniac assassinated Mr. Long, and his movement was never replaced by anyone of his ability.
No, not at all. And actually, Franklin D. Roosevelt was told by his advisors that he could not be reelected in 1936 if Huey Long ran against him. And so that was why Long was assassinated.
Well, maniac, that suicidal maniac who killed him, I know, was promptly shot dead by the guards of Huey Long. And,
well, they also, a lot of people believe that Huey Long was shot by his own bodyguard. And
I've heard that. Is there any solid evidence to that?
Pardon?
Is there any solid evidence to that?
There is no solid evidence because the thing happened very quickly, and it was there in the Capitol in Louisiana. And there really is no solid evidence, but the prevailing theory in Louisiana is that he was shot by the bodyguard.
Okay. All right.
All right. We have a break coming up here. Dave, if you want to hang on for the break, feel free to do it.
Okay.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Michael Collins Piper asking you to stay tuned for more of Eustace Mullins. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Michael Collins Piper here with Eustace Mullins, and we also have a caller, Dave from Massachusetts. Dave, if you don't mind me breaking in here in your time, I'd like to ask Eustace about something.
Yes.
You know, this is something about the same era of Huey Long and so forth. Maybe it actually goes back a little bit earlier, but the Lindbergh kidnapping case, Willis Cardo and I were just talking about this just yesterday, Eustace, and I told Willis that I had a vague memory that you had written a very interesting piece on the Lindbergh kidnapping case that James Warner published in I believe it was in the Christian Defense League report. You did some work on that, did you not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, what I recall that, well, I mean, basically you take issue with the official version of history, and I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, what was the official version that I sponsored?
Well, as I recall, you said that Bruno Hauptmann was innocent, and he, of course, was that German-American, and that there may have been, as I recall, there may have been some other aspects to the story. It's been years since I read it.
There's a lot of access to that. You know, his widow, Anna Hauptmann, fought for years to try to get a post-mortem hearing of her husband, that he was entirely innocent of the crime.
Yeah, and of course, even today it's kind of interesting. Lindbergh, of course, became notorious during the years leading up to World War II for refusing to support U.S. entry into the war. And to this day, he's called a Nazi apologist and an anti-Semite and so forth. And there have been a lot of people who have suggested that maybe the kidnapping of his child was which, of course, took place some years previous to World War II, but some people suggested maybe that kidnapping was retaliation against Lindbergh for his political views. Do you have any thoughts on that, Eustace?
Oh, a lot of that. I treat this in my book to some extent. You see, his father, Congressman Charles Lindbergh Sr., was the leader of the opposition to the Federal Reserve System in 1913.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they drove him out of Congress on a rail. Every congressman who voted against the Federal Reserve System in 1913 was run out of Congress within the next 2 years.
That's interesting that particular issue of money. I guess it's interesting but not surprising. That issue of money seems to be
well, money comes first, you know.
That's right.
Counterfeit money, most of all. This is all counterfeit money.
Well, that's right. Dave, did you have any further questions to Eustace? I broke in there on you.
Yes, I want to say this to Eustace and to the radio audience and to you, Michael. You mentioned Charles Lindbergh. People like Charles Lindbergh, Gerald Nye, Burton K. Wheeler, David I. Walsh, all these senators and representatives who were leaders in this anti-war movement before 1941 when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, these people who have taken over the Republican Party today and call themselves conservatives, they don't want you to know that guys like the people I mentioned and Taft even existed. They are trying to bury them like you bury something 10,000 feet deep. It just shows you the complete turnaround we've had in American politics and the kind of people who have taken over the Republican Party, especially very strong influence since the time of, Reagan in the 1980s. And a lot of people didn't realize it, and I was one of them, didn't realize it, that Goldwater was a precursor of Reagan.
Oh, yes, certainly.
You know, I got to give credit where credit is due, although I've written a lot about the neoconservatives in my over the last several years. I can tell you that if you look back to Eustace Mullins' book, The World Order, and in a lot of his speeches at that time frame, that's going back to the mid-1980s, it was Eustace Mullins who was telling the American conservatives that the Trotskyites were taking over the Republican Party. And, you know, Eustace, I think a lot of people just found that hard to believe, but now they're seeing that what you warned about 25 years ago is exactly what's happening here in this country today in the Republican Party.
Well, I started Pat Buchanan on his expose of the neocons because I had written articles about this at that time saying that the neocons were the Trotskyites and that the Trotskyites and the Stalinists were still fighting. And the Trotskyites won over the Stalinists in the United States, and that is why Reagan made his speech about the party of evil, the communists in Russia. That he was anti-Stalinist because he was totally surrounded by Trotskyite communists in his cabinet in Washington, D.C. when Reagan was elected president.
Yeah, that's the funny part of it, that so many people failed to understand what was happening. They still bought into these old lines of liberal and conservative and Republican and Democrat. And
the thing had completely changed by that time. It was Trotskyites versus Stalinists.
That's right, exactly. And then the rest of us patriots are supposed to be on the outside shouting inward.
Oh, yeah.
Pounding on the windows. All right, Dave, listen, I want to thank you for your call. We're going to the end of the half hour here, and we have two more callers here for you, Eustace. You want to stick around to talk to them, or do you have to run?
No, I'll take care of it.
All right, great. Well, we'll be back in about 2 minutes here, folks, and we'll take your other calls here for Eustace Mullen. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here with Eustace Mullins, who's been very generous with his time here taking calls. I know a lot of you have been very interested to chat with Eustace, and we have at least two remaining callers here. We're going to go ahead and bring them up before we let Eustace retire for the evening. We have Roddy in Canada.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. Hello, Michael. Hello, Mr. Mullins.
Hello.
I am a great admirer of your Murder by Injection book, which I found not long ago, digging into the medical cartel and the insurance cartel. And therefore, later I found many other books of yours, and you have been indirectly responsible for my awakening, so to speak, and discovery of people like Benjamin Friedman and Aaron Sagan, as well as Mike Piper and
okay.
Christopher Bolin. And in an interview Christopher Bolin did on RBN on July 28, 2006, that's also information for the listeners, he had a great interview about the use of drugs, and especially antidepressants that are so widely used in the United States now, and where I'm calling from in Canada, and their effect on the population in general. And they've also been medicating the spouses of 9/11 victims, etc. Could you comment on that widespread of these medications? And do you know why and what is behind that epidemic of them? Another question I have would be for regarding Benjamin Friedman, and would you agree with his account of the role of the Zionist in the First World War and getting the United States involved in the war? And the third question I have is to more recent history. Do you have any information about the bank's role in the fall of the Iron Curtain? And thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, the Benjamin Friedman is quite correct that our involvement in World War One was due entirely to the Balfour Declaration, which Lord Rothschild had promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine. And that is what brought America into the side of Britain in World War One. Now, while Woodrow Wilson was president, he was appointed, Brandeis, Justice Brandeis.
Yeah, Brandeis, yeah.
Who was the head of the World Zionist Organization, and who was one of the principal contributors to Woodrow Wilson's re-election campaign. Bernard Baruch gave a $50,000 contribution to Woodrow Wilson for re-election, which at that time was the largest political contribution which had ever been made in the United States.
That's a pretty substantial amount even today when it comes right down to it. So.
Well, it really is.
Yeah.
Not many people contribute $50,000 to a political candidate.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That put Brandeis on the Supreme Court, and it also made Washington a part of the World Zionist Movement.
Yeah, well, that Benjamin Friedman, it's kind of interesting. His original name, as I understand it, was spelled F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N-N, I believe. Maybe two N's or one.
Well,
but after, after he gave up Judaism and abandoned Zionism and became a Christian, he changed the spelling to F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N.
Yeah.
To say that he was a freed man.
That's exactly right. He was a freed man.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I first heard about Benjamin Friedman from our old friend, DeWest Hooker, who died here in Washington just a couple years ago, a mutual friend of ours. You certainly knew him well going back into the 1950s.
Well, Wes Hooker and Ben Friedman used to go out to dinner together almost every night.
Yeah, well, that's where I first heard of Benjamin Friedman. Wes used to tell me stories about him, and then of course I discovered that Liberty Lobby had actually sponsored Willis Cardo, and Liberty Lobby had actually sponsored the famous speech by Friedman that people often quote today. I think it was at the Willard Hotel here in Washington. Liberty Lobby circulated thousands of tapes of that years and years ago in the old cassette tapes. Benjamin Friedman must have been quite a guy. He came from a very wealthy family, did he not?
Oh, well, he did, and he also was a big supporter of Roosevelt at one time in the early 30s. And Roosevelt gave him the Woodbury Soap Company and made him a very wealthy man because, the New Deal was handing out prizes to people. And so Ben Friedman was one of his supporters, and so he gave him the Woodbury Soap Company, which made Friedman quite wealthy, and he started a newspaper called Common Sense, which I joined, and I became the chief writer for it. And I wrote whole issues of Common Sense under 8 different names, because you could have one person writing the whole paper.
Right, exactly.
But those were the great days. I tell you, I was on the go 7 days a week in those days.
That was quite a paper, Common Sense. They used to run a lot of those Friedman speeches as
Friedman totally financed it. He backed the entire paper.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Yeah, the caller Roddy from Canada had also asked you to comment, Eustace, on this whole the drugging of America, but the drugging of the world and the role of these big drug companies in all of this. And that's obviously, as she said, that's what you wrote about in Murder by Injection.
Oh, yes, antidepressants are very dangerous. A lot of people have had heart attacks on them. You read about the Vioxx trials in the papers today because so many people developed heart attacks and strokes and blood clots from Vioxx. And all these antidepressants are very dangerous because they directly affect the blood circulation and cause clots.
It's amazing, Eustace. I don't know how many times in the last several years I've turned around and have had friends or even family members come back from the doctors, and doctors have recommended some of these poisonous, murderous substances for them.
Oh, they're murderous. I've never taken an antidepressant in my life.
Oh, it's absolutely
amazing.
In fact,
I've never been depressed. I'm too busy.
That's right. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Yeah.
All right. We have another caller here wanting to talk to you, so we'll bring him up here. It's Patrick from Atlanta.
Hello.
Patrick, you've been very patient. We were at the tail end here, but we got you in.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. I wanted to say, first of all, thank you for taking my call, and also it's a real pleasure to get to hear Mr. Mullins. And first of all, I wanted to ask what year he was born.
Oh, 1923.
He's been around for
a while longer.
I certainly hope so. I hope
Eustace doesn't look his age, he doesn't sound his age, he doesn't act his age.
Secondly, I wanted to ask if Mr. Mullins had ever written any books on the subject of Freemasonry, and if not, if possibly maybe he could recommend some.
Well, the best one is actually one of my books, The Curse of Canaan. It gives the whole history of the Freemason movement from its origins in ancient Babylon to the present day. The book is out of print right now. People are offering $1,000 a copy of it. They were so anxious to get it. But I'm going to try to get it reprinted in the next few months.
Wow, that would be great. And that
blog is where you want to keep an eye on there, Patrick, at eustacemullins.blogspot.com.
All right. And one thing, if I could, before I go, I was wanting to respond to something that I believe Bob from D.C. called earlier and brought up the Articles of Confederation. and the transformation and how we got from the Articles to the Constitution. And I basically wanted to point out and clarify the fact that the Constitution, the convention itself, was all part of a big conspiracy, of course. If you go back and you read the testimony and the transcripts of the debates and what the people like William Patterson, Brierley, Gunning Bedford Jr., Mason, and all those guys read their testimonies, and then you'll read the Anti-Federalist Papers, you can't help but understand, first of all, Madison lied when he sent out the invitations to get people to the Constitutional Convention. So they were going there to discuss ways to amend the Articles of Confederation, but he intended to scrap them.
Oh, yeah, they scrapped them entirely.
Because they prevented them. The Federalists needed to get their hands on a lot of money. And the obstacle was the Articles of Confederation, which stipulated that all states retain their sovereignty and their independence and their freedom, and everything had to go through the state's legislatures.
Oh, yeah.
They couldn't get any money out of the people's pockets unless they bypassed the state's legislatures to do it. And that's how they cut the state legislatures out.
Oh, yeah.
It was by coming up with the Constitution itself. They bribed six people who were against the Constitution. During the convention, they bribed them. Hell, they had to bribe George Washington to get him there. I mean, he was given the presidency. The man was sent to the Constitutional Convention. He'd never been trained in law or any judicial background whatsoever. He had no qualifications to be there. Neither did Benjamin Franklin. And you start going back. Anyway, I've written a whole big manuscript. I'd like to get it published. I've been working on this project for about 6 years now to explain how we lost our freedoms and became enslaved, just like Melanchthon Smith claimed, just like Patrick Henry claimed at the state's ratification conventions. They were basically saying that the Constitution was an instrument of tyranny. Even Benjamin Franklin himself stated that the constitutional, or the government that was created, the federal government, would eventually have to turn to despotism in order to control we, the people. And Wilson, James Wilson, foreign-born Scotsman, he said during the ratification convention for the state of Pennsylvania, he openly proclaimed that they chose despotism as the model for the federal government. Those comments almost got him beat to death.
Well, it's one of them was killed because the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was a secret conspiracy. All the delegates were Masons, and that was done in secret. Their armed guards were present all during the writing of the Constitution. There was no allowing any free speech or anything like that.
You know, that's something I'm glad to hear both of you saying this, because, you know, so many patriots in the United States have this, how can I put this gently, they have a knee-jerk reaction to say that, well, the Constitution is the thing. This is our form of government. This is the best thing. This is God created. This is, you know, and you know, yet at the same time, many of those same people want to amend the Constitution for their pet amendments that they want to add, or they want to take things out of the Constitution they don't like. So maybe the big start, maybe the best start, is to go back to the very beginning and just see how we got the Constitution in the first place.
Oh, yes, that's very well worth looking into.
It would be good to go back to the Articles of Confederation if we could, but even then, if you realize that the first battles of the war, the outbreak, I call them skirmishes, they were on April the 19th, 1775, there at Bunker Hill, or not Bunker Hill, but when they gauged, took his men and they went through to seize the arms on April the 18th, and they showed up and they had two skirmishes the next day on April the 19th. That was the beginning. Then they had the meeting, first meeting in the Continental Congress, and then they had another second meeting in July or June, I believe, of 1776. That's when they put together the committees to form the Declaration of Independence. They formed another 11 man committee to write up the Articles of Confederation. Well, they didn't write up the Articles of Confederation until months later, and they didn't even vote on, they didn't even start debating on them until about a year after that. So we were over 2.5 years into the war before we even had any written agreement whatsoever between any of the states. In other words, the Articles of Confederation were not even necessary for the object of the war. If the object of the war was independence, there was no written agreement between any of the states when they rose up and started fighting the British.
Well, you know, this is what we call revisionist history. That's why we have the Barnes Review magazine. Eustace, you were an old friend of Harry Elmer Barnes, and now we've got the Barnes Review to try to publish some of this revisionist history to, as Barnes said, bring history into accord with the facts. That's why, your name is Patrick?
That's correct.
Patrick, yeah, listen, once you get that manuscript all written up and put together, why don't you send that on up to the Barnes Review in Washington, D.C.? And
I certainly will.
Yeah,
maybe we can
consider getting that book out there, because we know there's a lot of good writers and a lot of good books out there that need to be written, and in the case of Eustace's books, republished. So keep that in mind, Patrick.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I got to move on here.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, Eustace, we have Eric Shine on. Eric's been a host on this network here. We're going to bring Eric up. Eric, how you doing tonight? Hello? Hello? Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm right.
You're
here.
There. We lost somebody there. Eric Shine, are you there? No, Eric, I guess we lost Eric Shine. All right, well, Eustace, we got one of your friends. Well, let's put it this way, somebody from Virginia, and I assume he's a friend if he's calling in here. Bill from Virginia.
Bill from Virginia, right. How you tonight, Mike? Enjoying your program with your guest, Mr. Mullins.
All right.
I was fortunate enough right after Katrina to catch an interview with Mr. Mullins by Pastor Peters.
Okay, Pete Peters, right.
Yeah,
I've been on his show, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was a while back, and I was really fascinated. Mr. Mullins made a comment, getting back to the Charles Lindbergh thing, that he was really never killed. The child had a deformity and was shipped off to another state.
Yeah, he had a club foot.
And yeah, he had a club foot.
Lindbergh couldn't stand the idea of a son with a club foot or an imperfection like that, and so he farmed the kid out. I know the present Charles Lindbergh is still alive and still in San Jose, and he's supposed to go on national network telling his story last month, but I don't know what happened to it.
Yeah, I recall. I believe there was a book written that followed through on that, and it said that the whole that the Lindbergh child was in fact still alive. That there was much more to that story, and that.
I spent a lot of time with the present Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful person.
Yeah, he's living in Texas, you say?
San Jose, California.
San Jose, California. Okay,
I found that fascinating.
Well, he's getting on in years now, and his health's not too good.
And I think he made a comment that he was going public with his story or something.
Yeah. He was supposed to go public several times, and I offered to help him and so forth, but every time, because of his health problems, he decided not to go through with it.
Oh. And another point that you brought up. Well,
you know what? We have a break coming up here, Bill, so you hang on there. When we come back, we're going to wrap up this 2 hours with Eustace Mullins, so stay tuned, folks. And try to get another caller in here, Jim from New York. This is Michael Collins Piper. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. It's hard to believe, but we've been on here for almost 2 hours, and we are going to be wrapping it up. We have Bill from Virginia on with a call from his, with a question or continuing comment for his fellow Virginian, Eustace Mullins. Bill,
yeah,
did you have another comment there?
Yeah, the other comment was on the same interview. Mr. Mullins indicated that he had worked for Joe McCarthy behind the scenes and was supplying a lot of information that he was putting out at that time on communism. I found that very interesting. Would he comment on that?
Oh, yes. Joe didn't really know anything about the real nature of communism. I did a special 25-page report for him, which detailed the Wall Street and Jewish origins of communism. And so he delivered that speech to businessmen in Chicago, and it really wowed them. They were gave him a standing ovation for about 5 minutes. And so Bernard Baruch called Joe to his apartment at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City, and he told Joe that he must never mention again the banking origins of communism, or he wouldn't get for any good for that would be his last day. And so he never did after that.
That's kind of interesting. Our old friend Wes Tucker put together a report on the that group, the American Jewish League Against Communism, which was funded by Bernard Baruch. And they,
oh, yes, it was a fake organization.
Yeah, they were basically a Zionist organization.
Oh, absolutely.
Posing as anti-communist, and they moved in on Senator McCarthy as quick as they could to try to
well, they did. They put
control
Conan
him.
Chine.
Yeah.
They put Conan Chine on him, and they destroyed his campaign against communism. Roy Cohn's father, Marcus Cohn, was the head of the Anti-Defamation League. He was a judge in New York City, and he was head of the Anti-Defamation League. And just so he delivered Joe to the Zionists.
Yeah, do you think he was murdered, Eustace, Joe McCarthy? Do you think they finally killed him, or do you think that was the
natural
cause?
Oh, I've seen
the
death certificate, and it says homicide.
Really? That's very, very interesting. Okay.
I've spoken at his gravesite at Appleton several times. And the first time I went up there, they handed me the, Joe's death certificate. It said homicide.
So he was among the people that had to be rubbed out because
he had to go.
He knew too much. Yeah.
Well, not only that, he'd become too powerful. He was the most powerful political figure in the United States. Eisenhower was terrified of him.
That's
and then
interesting.
Dick Nixon led the conspiracy to overthrow Joe McCarthy.
And they certainly succeeded. That's
how Nixon got to be president.
That's the price a lot of these guys have paid to achieve greater power, and that's all part of the game.
Oh, it's all part of the game. They got rid of Nixon the same way.
No matter how much water you carry for these people, they still go after you.
Oh, absolutely. When it's your time to go, you go.
Well, you know what, Eustace? Speaking of time to go, we are running out of time here. I want to thank all the callers that have called in here tonight, and you have been very, very patient and sat through a lot of calls and a lot of different issues, and I appreciate that, Eustace. And I know
you had some
the listeners.
Wonderful callers tonight. That's always a good experience to get good callers in like that.
Yeah, well, we'll do it again real soon, Eustace. I appreciate it, and I thank you again. It's been a lot of fun. So
very good.
All right, you take care of yourself, Eustace. Ladies and gentlemen, what can I say? That's Eustace Mullins, and I'm Mike Piper, and I'm wrapping it up here for the evening, but I will see you here tomorrow night. Hope you'll stay tuned for the rest of the evening here on this important network, because you can handle the truth. We'll be back here tomorrow night, regular time. Stay tuned for more, folks. Have a good evening.